Zhihar Tsarnaev has acknowledged his involvement in the bombings at the Boston Marathon, the killing of a police officer at MIT, and the shootout with police in Watertown, Massachusetts, which left his brother dead. In day 11 of the federal death penalty trial of Tsarnaev, the government posed this question to its expert witness. What turns a seemingly average teenager from Cambridge into a violent radical intent on and capable of deadly acts of terrorism? This is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen with the Boston Globe.
Kevin, when the government put its expert witness on, I expected that we were going to recline Tsarnaev into a couch and have a psychoanalysis here, a psychologist looking at him and determining what he did. That's not what we got. It was much more like a think tank symposium.
It was like a class in geopolitics, something you might hear at the Kennedy School over at Harvard or the Fletcher School at Tufts, which may not be a coincidence because Matthew Levitt, the government expert witness in this case, got both his master's and his PhD at the Fletcher School.
So all of a sudden, we're talking about the Caucasus. We're talking Chechnya, Syria,
global jihad,
Pakistan, Afghanistan, and what he calls the global jihadi movement.
Yeah, and he was talking about that what has changed in the last 10 years, that before Al-Qaeda was this sort of dominant force in the jihadi world, and it was all focused with them, and you had to go there, or people going there to join them. And what has happened in the last 10 years, he talked about, as being particularly because of social media, the world's gotten flatter. And the jihadist movement, the global jihadist movement, has realized it offers people two alternatives. You either can immigrate and come and join them and fight, or you fight where you are. And obviously the prosecution is arguing that Zhihar Tsarnaev fell into that latter group, and he decided to fight where he was, which was Boston, Massachusetts.
We're talking in general, as the testimony continues, though he hasn't linked it yet to Zhihar, but he's talking about the razzle-dazzle approach to young Muslims out there, the idea of terrorism on the go. Through the use of slick media, social media, he talks about that and wrapping it up into a religious theme, all of it intended to make jihadi as American as apple pie.
Yeah, and the sort of poster boy for this is Anwar al-Awlaki. His lectures, his words, his thoughts are all over the computer and electronic devices that were at the behest of Zhihar Tsarnaev.
An inspiration to many, an American who later left America of Yemeni parents, was assassinated by the United States with a drone attack. But he's credited with inspiring the attack by Major Nidal Hassan in Fort Hood that killed, 13 in 2009, the attempted car bomb in Times Square in 2010, inspiring the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, even though he'd been dead.
Yeah.
That's right, for a number of years. And it's also said that Zhihar Tsarnaev being interrogated after his capture here in Boston credited Awlaki as well for inspiration.
The genius of Awlaki is that he was able to use, and Levitt talked about this, colloquial English. Because he had grown up in America, he was able to talk to particularly American kids, but also kids in the West, English kids, who they would have previously relied on either translated transcripts of some cleric thousands of miles away. This was a guy who spoke like somebody on the corner. This is how a kid like Zhihar Tsarnaev, totally Americanized, immersed in American culture, who was as likely to have on his computer a song by Jay-Z as he was to have a lecture from Awlaki there, he could understand what Awlaki was saying.
Right. All of that I agree with. You say sounded like he was on the corner, except he had the voice, the church voice. That was the mosque voice.
Yeah.
In fact, let's listen to him.
And he did join with the Muslims in Uhud, and he fought, and he was wounded. So before he dies, some of his relatives come to him and said, when they saw him, they said, "This is Osirin." As far as we know, he wasn't interested in becoming Muslim. What is he doing here? So they rush up to him and they ask him, they said, "Osirin, did you fight for the sake of Islam, or did you fight for the honor of your people?" He said, "No, I fought for the sake of Islam."
Now, that's a story he tells of Osirin. So somebody who had not been a devout Muslim. what makes it okay to commit acts of violence, what makes it acceptable, not only acceptable and permissible, but praiseworthy, is why it's done. It's done for Allah. And therefore, there is the reward in Jannah, the highest level of heaven.
Yeah, the way Al-Laki puts it, too, and explains it to so many potential recruits, like an average American kid, is it doesn't matter what you did before. It doesn't matter, as in Jahar Zanayev's case, you were selling marijuana down at your college at UMass Dartmouth. If you engage in jihad, you will get the highest form of paradise available to you.
And here, the prosecution effectively ties this to the note on the boat. The boat in which Jahar Zanayev has been hiding and from which he emerges that Friday night, 4 days after the bombings. And this cannot help but chill the jurors. He writes, "No, you are fighting men who look into the barrel of your gun and see heaven." And that's matched with some of the religious statements by the firebrand Al-Waqi, as well as Inspire magazine found on the computer that's controlled by Jahar, in which Al-Waqi says, among other things, "We will fight for him, we will instigate, we will bomb, and we will assassinate, and may our mothers be bereaved of us if we do not rise in his defense."
Previously, David, both the government and we in the media have characterized what was written on the boat, in effect, a confession. In the words of Levitt, the government's witness today, what was included in there was a statement of intention, and that it is essential if you are a jihadi, you have to state your intention. Why did you do this? And that's what the note says. It says, this is why we did it. It is a statement of intention, and it is taken right from the jihadi playbook.
Here, again, is from the note in the boat. This is Jahar writing, "I'm jealous of my brother who has received the reward." And the reward, of course, he's going to Jannah, heaven. "I do not mourn because his soul is very much alive. God has a plan for each person. Mine was to hide in his boat and shed some light on our actions. I ask Allah to make me a shaheed, a martyr, to allow me to return to him and be among the righteous people in the highest levels of heaven. I got to tell you, as a courtroom observer, I'm dying to find out what the defense makes of this."
But if you're a juror sitting there, David, do you really believe that this is somebody, a 19-year-old kid, who's just casually interested in this kind of stuff, or that in that moment, without any reference material around him, he could lie in a boat and with a number two pencil from a plumbing contractor write that screed? It is infused with the language of jihad. It is somebody well-versed in the rhetoric and the phraseology of the jihadist movement, and that's what the government witness testified
Kevin,
to today.
Kevin, that it's true, and I accept the power of that. At the same time, we're dealing with a stoner, and like so many of the people that Anwar Al-Waqi is appealing to, he's not observant. He's worried about his friends meeting his brother because his brother's going to discover they're all stoners. And so somehow the idea that someone is completely immersed so totally and loyally as this just doesn't quite fly that easily.
In a Western analysis of this, but that is what the government's arguing here, that what Jahar was actually looking for after all these years of smoking dope, of dealing dope, he was looking for absolution. And absolution is guaranteed by the jihadist movement if, in fact, you engage in the very act his own lawyers admitted he engaged in, a horrible act of violence. Obviously, what they have said is, we dispute the government's contention of why he did it. And they clearly are going to say and have indicated that it was the older brother who drove this whole thing, that Jahar would not have been there without the older brother's involvement. But what is really damaging to the defense's case, David, I think it was right in front of us. You have to sit there and ask yourself, does somebody who is being led by the nose by an older extremist brother have the capability to pull that language out of his head in such a situation?
And why, Kevin, did he not stand up
and
go out in glory, which would have brought him, like Osiris, to Jannah? You know, why didn't he stand up and be the martyr he could have been? There is the question of whether or not all that stuff on all those devices was, in fact, Jahar's doing.
I think the defense scored on two fronts on that point, David. First of all, they established beyond any reasonable doubt that unless you're standing over somebody's shoulder at the moment they're downloading, you don't know who downloaded this information. They can't prove it one way or the other. The second thing, Bill Fick, the defense attorney, I think was very successful in showing, is that what the FBI took off Jahar's devices, his computers and everything else, was just a fraction of what was on that computer. And as he put it, the vast majority of what was on there, you'd see it was
teenage stuff.
It was, you know, The Walking Dead. It was Jay-Z songs. It's what he said you would see on the average American adolescent male's computer.
In the top 16 items, nothing about jihad or Islam.
Nothing.
I mean, we got to hear the cross, obviously. Right. But this brings us to the end of day 11 in the federal death penalty trial of Jahar Zinayev. And you've been listening to Finish Line, Inside the Boston Marathon Bombing Trial. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, I'm David Boer for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Join us again tomorrow.
Finish Line, Inside the Boston Marathon Bombing Trial is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at BostonGlobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.